4-year-old Maram prays to God to heal her. She prays that she goes back to the way she was before the war in Gaza. Today, she has shrapnel lodged in her head, and she's blind. I was sitting next to Maram and her mother on a Boeing 777 Etihad flight to Abu Dhabi after it took off from Al Arish Military Airport in Egypt to bring patients to the UAE for treatment. Al Arish is the closest point I can get to Rafah, which is only 45 minutes away from the border crossing, Gaza's only exit right now. More than 77,000 people have been wounded in Israeli attacks on Gaza since October 7. On flights like these, you see sick men, women, and children. Their injuries might seem visible like burns on the face or legs, or invisible like people who have cancer and are suffering silently. They are all exhausted, sometimes in pain, and mostly afraid, with their realization that they had left Gaza not really settling in. Their guilt from having left family behind, not leaving them. One of the people on the plane asked me if she can watch the news to find out if a deal has been struck between Hamas and Israel to end the war there. In the background of all that, airline crew members get blankets, food, and drink. They open and close bathroom doors for people who have never used a plane toilet before. They call for a nurse when someone needs assistance. They make sure that companions who are often sick themselves are well fed too. They offer them snacks, fruits, and sweets. Ala, a mother of two who was bringing her 4-year-old son, Thabit, to Abu Dhabi after both his legs were severely burned in an explosion, said she hasn't seen a banana in 7 months, as she held one given to her by a member of the staff. This is Beyond the Headlines, and I'm your host, Nada Al-Tahir. And this week, I'm taking you inside one of the flying hospitals that have taken hundreds of Gazans to the UAE for treatment, and tell you why some patients willingly choose to go back to Gaza after receiving treatment here. One day, it's equipped with 10 stretchers, 55 people from medical teams, operations, and officials. And the next day, it could be going to a place like the Maldives. This is the Etihad plane I got on for a second time to cover how the UAE is evacuating patients from Gaza. Often, the people on board those flights are people who live in the UAE. But one of them caught my attention. She was not expected to be there with us. Her face was full of hope, fear, and tears. And unlike myself and the rest of the people on the flight, she was not coming back with us to Abu Dhabi.
My entire family is in Gaza. I'm married with two boys. I did not get married away from my family. My family is there. May God protect them and fend off the Israeli danger.
This is 33-year-old Maryam Jamal Awad. She is a mother of two who had arrived to Abu Dhabi in December to receive treatment for breast cancer as part of the UAE's mission to bring over 2,000 sick and injured Gazans for medical assistance.
It's very, very difficult. I know that it's difficult, but I want to go back because we love our country. I'm certain that God will remove this grief.
Maryam had been receiving cancer treatment in Gaza since 2020, but all that stopped when Israel launched its war on Gaza nearly 7 months ago, and she said that the hospital she was being treated in at the Strip was hit and destroyed completely, and that the Israeli attacks exacerbated her symptoms. Now, Maryam wants to go back, against the advice of her husband, to return to her homeland and be reunited with her children, who keep asking for her to return.
As Palestinians, we've shown the world what it means to be resilient in one's own land. There is no life for a person if they are not living on their own land.
Rafah, her home city, is the only urban area of Gaza that has become a sanctuary for more than 1.5 million people who have been displaced there. Every single one of them now is under threat by an impending Israeli invasion of Rafah that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he is determined to see through. I had the pleasure of speaking to Medical Commander Joe Coughlin and asked him how he oversees the task of converting a Boeing 777 commercial flight into a flying hospital.
We've kind of broken the plane into, in terms of patients and passengers, we've broken it into three main sections. There are the patients that will need to come in and have stretchers. And they will come in through the high loader and the door. We've even selected the right doors because relevant to the type of loader that's used, and it's also sometimes relevant to the type of airframe that's used.
What's an airframe?
The airplane, the actual type of aircraft. Right. So like this is a 777. There could be a 787, a slightly different aircraft.
Right.
So all of those nuances force you to slightly maneuver a little bit. But the three categories for us are always the patients and their escorts, their colleagues who can walk. So they can sit in any one of the 200 odd chairs that we have. Then we have specifically allocated out all of the chairs at the front of the emergency exits. And they're there for a reason in terms of the people that need wheelchair access or that just need that little bit of leg room so that we can bring them in the wheelchair and we can then have more, because trying to maneuver a wheelchair, you know, it's easier in those spaces.
Yeah.
And then the last one is the patients that need, like I said, to come in on the stretchers and so on. So stretchers, wheelchairs, walkers.
Who needs a stretcher, usually?
Depends. You could have patients...
Like what types of injuries?
You could have elderly patients that have oncology, cancer, and they're just very weak and frail. So they need more mobility assistance and anything else. Or they're simply more comfortable lying down than they are trying to sit. You could have had people who have maybe have had operations and post-surgical, they need to be lying down instead of sitting. And you could have had people who have had some kind of injuries and therefore it would require them to be in a prone position, a lying down position as well. So it really depends on the individual needs of the patients. But we have enough capacity here to be able to do with the stretchers. We also have a fallback, which is the business class, that allows us to do that as well. So we can pivot and change.
Right, because the seats there incline a little bit.
Correct, they go down. They're just short of 6 feet long and they can go down fully flat. So if we needed to bring somebody in and put them down, we could use that as if we had more than, say, the 10 stretchers that we need.
There are many types of patients. Those who are able to climb the stairs normally and those who need wheelchair access. There's strategic planning as to where to seat each one of them, with regards to spaces and allowing some of them more legroom where needed. The plane is also equipped with resuscitation beds, which in hospitals typically give medical teams 360-degree access. I asked Joe how the crew handles this intense job and what his favorite part of doing it is.
It's always amazing to be involved in it because you have such a sense of camaraderie. You have such a sense of mission pride. We're very proud of all of what we can do. And ultimately, when you see the plane filling up with patients and the escorts, you see children, you see elderly people, you see in their faces that they're safe. And maybe they didn't have that feeling for a while. That is, as I've said, it's food for the soul. That no matter how tired you are, you think of those things the day after. So when you've had a good sleep and you're not tired anymore, that's the stuff that keeps bringing you, you know, back to the reason why we do it. And it's the one that keeps giving the smile and letting, you could be sitting there and have a cup of coffee by yourself and you'll just smile because you're running through stuff like this.
Yeah.
So to be part of a team, to be able to serve and answer the mission requirements, to be able to succeed as the team, the ability for all of that. And then when you physically see, like there's patients on the plane today.
Oh yeah.
That traveled back with us a few missions ago. They're healthy enough to be able to go back and make that decision.
While speaking to Joe, I was looking around to check for more details on the flying hospital and how each corner of it looks different. It took a moment to grasp that this same aircraft could be flying somewhere else yesterday or flying normally or commercially to another destination in a few days. I asked Joe about all of that and the cooperation of the cabin crew that this all required.
Internationally, yes, there is flights that are medical flights that specifically fly to retrieve people.
Of course,
but
yes.
In terms of turning
a
commercial aircraft, which could have been on a different flight 2 days ago, into a flying hospital, bringing all the resources onto the hospital or into the flying hospital, and then deliver that to achieve this mission. I'm not really sure that that's been done in the scale that we're doing it.
Yes.
And the consistency of which we're doing it. One of the key lessons that we were able to learn earlier on was we've got multiple teams here with really, really good experience in the different stages. So from a command structure point of view, you need to step back a little bit and decide which lever and which strength you play. It's like playing chess. Which one are you going to move in order to achieve what you need to achieve? When we stood back and looked at the Etihad crew, it was clear to us that the people are coming through this long process. We don't know what they were even going through before they got to this process. Yeah. So we can only imagine. Every step through that process, they would have seen an authority figure. They might have seen a police officer or a military soldier or immigration or anybody along those lines. And all those people are very important. They have their jobs to do and roles to do. But it's always in a uniform. It's always an authority figure, yes. When you then take Etihads, they have their uniforms, but they're not the authority figure.
It's inevitable that trips like this will have such an emotional reaction from some of the teams involved. I asked Joe about one of his most memorable ones.
I remember literally 10 feet from where we're sitting, and I don't know if I told you in the last time we met, and I still clearly remember there was a lady who had delivered her little girl in the conflict zone in the house that had been literally bombed. No medical assistance. Beautiful little girl was born. She was only 3 weeks old when that lady and her little daughter came to us. The Etihad crew put her into a new little baby group. They put her into a bassinet up here, and her mother was sitting right in front of her. And I went by, because I have four girls.
Yeah.
Right? So little baby girls remind me of my girls when they were all way back so young. And you know when a baby's having a really good sleep, they put their arms up like this, like I give up. I give up, right? They put up. She was like that. And her mother was crying. And I checked on the mother and said, "Are you okay?" She said, "That is the first time since she's born that I know she's really, really safe."
The process keeps improving every time. It's not the first time that I cover evacuation trips from Gaza for medical treatment. I remember before, the plane would first pick up the passengers from Al Arish, then head to Cairo, where the Etihad crew would be switched out to prevent them from exceeding their working hours. But after receiving the necessary approvals, the flight now stops at Cairo before heading to Al Arish, allowing the plane to head to Abu Dhabi directly from the Egyptian city closest to Gaza with no stopovers. This is also good news for the Gazan patients on board, who become more optimistic about their future the closer we get to Abu Dhabi and the more directly we get there. While waiting for the plane to take off, I got the chance to speak to cabin manager Kiran Sadashifan, who has been on board all but two of the 17 flights. I asked him about how he and his team prepares for such a special mission.
So behind the scenes, I would say our role in this particular mission as a cabin crew is making sure we provide the best hospitality service to each and everyone who comes on board. Hospitality for us is number one. Safety, always number one as well. But hospitality is something which we go out of our way for this one particular flight.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I wouldn't imagine that hospitality would be the Gazan people's number one kind of thing that they look out for. So what is hospitality in this case, and how is it different from the hospitality that you offer normal people on normal flights?
On a normal day-to-day flight, what we do is we greet them, we have them on board, we provide them food, we interact a little bit with them, and then end of the flight we say bye.
Yeah.
We stop it over there actually. Yeah. So there is not much of, I wouldn't say there's a lot of interaction which we manage to do with them on a normal day-to-day flight. But this particular flight, The people that we receive on this particular flight, what we do is we make an impact. We show them. They've been through a lot. For us, what we do on this particular flight is that we provide care. Whatever they have missed in these last few months,
yeah,
we provide it to them. From the time we leave Abu Dhabi, when I see my team, I tell them, one simple thing, do everything from your heart.
Yeah.
Forget about everything else. Everything that you do, it has to come out of your heart. That small gesture that you have, that you show, will completely change whatever they've been through And I know, because I've seen from day one of mission until now, when I see the impact or the change that we provide to these people that we receive, it's another level itself. They never forget us. They never forget us.
I also asked Kieran how things have changed since his first flight till today.
Things happening inside the aircraft, when it comes to service, when it comes to looking after things, it's changed a lot, because earlier we didn't know what was going to be the count, what was going to be the number, how the service is going to happen and everything. But now we know, we do everything in a systematic manner. From the time we board the aircraft till the time we leave the aircraft, there is everything done in a very systematic manner. So it's a big change.
What have been some of the lessons learned that you would say you would got out of this, whether to apply to this flight or normal flights?
Every time given the opportunity, I would always go for this.
Yeah.
No matter what, whichever destination I have, whichever flight I have, even if it's my day off, my management, they know I'm ready for that. Even if it's my day off, they call me and they ask me, and I always say,
yes,
I'm ready for it. It doesn't matter where I go. Remove me from a flight if it is possible for you to remove me from the flight. If you can remove me from my day off and assign me on the flight, I'm ready for it.
What I noticed on board these flights is that despite the long hours and exhaustion, sometimes up to 30 continuous hours at a time, everybody I spoke to said they were delighted to be there. Many of them had been on board one of these missions several times already and would say yes several times again. And while walking away from immigration, I looked around and saw almost every single doctor, nurse, security, and operations official smiling and in good spirits, even at 4 a.m. the next morning. Thank you for coming aboard this little trip with us. We hope this episode gave you the hope it gave me and the people who were with me on this flight. If you haven't already subscribed to Beyond the Headlines, please make sure that you do wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Arthur Edison and Dua Farid, and I'm your host, Nada Al-Tahir.